at 111 on WGN. 847 adding to the Sylvia Snowden praise. Sylvia has the smoothest, calming voice of anyone I've ever heard on radio. It's like velvet or satin. I like that. We call Mike Leonard Velvet Satin. Actually, that's his first. That was your college band name, Velvet Satin.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I have never had any skills.
That's
so
what they called your dorm room.
Velvet. No one ever accused me of being a band guy.
Let's just kind of clear the air here, Mike. You're a Sox fan through and through. Good for you.
100%. Grew up in Arlington Heights, which was, it was extremely unusual to be a Sox fan.
Mm-hmm.
I remember third, fourth, fifth grade sitting at your desk arguing Cubs Sox endlessly. I think, you know, part of it was me being a little bit of a contrarian, John.
Yeah, I could see that, right? That doesn't surprise me. So you grew up around Cubs fans, so you became a Sox fan.
Maybe. Really, the key was my father, and I think I've told the story before, my father was originally from Milwaukee. We moved to the Chicago suburbs. You know, he was a guy who, if you couldn't park readily, it bothered him. So I think we went to a Cubs game first. It bothered him to no end how difficult it was to get a spot. This, we're talking mid-1970s.
Right.
Comiskey Park had the gravel lot, very easy, you know.
Plus,
we used to get those perfect attendance tickets. I don't know if there's any listeners who remember, but when you're in grade school, junior high, back in the 70s, maybe early 80s, Sox would give you a perfect attendance ticket. So, I don't know if it really motivated me to go to school, but I was happy to get the free tickets.
Oh, that's cool. Well, yeah, you and I were talking off air, and I was in for John Williams earlier this week, and I was just saying it's not a weekend for both siders. And if you are a fan of both teams or you're okay with both teams, we've beaten this to a pulp the last couple of days on WGN, but that's fine. Just do it. But I just think that this is the weekend to not compliment or respect each other. Like these 3 days, oh, I don't want to say anything. I don't want to gear you up to say a swear, but like you do you. I don't like the Sox this weekend. Go Cubs.
Oh, yeah. I'm 100%. I hate this whole, oh, I'm rooting for them both, or I want to see them both do well. Don't buy it. Never been behind it. Hate the Cubs. Always root against them.
Rooting against them in 2016, or was that the moment where you were even like, for my Cubs fans, I'm happy for them, friends?
Do I need to tell the truth?
Yes, you do.
Rooting against them.
Really?
I remember remember when I was in college, Cubs played the Padres. Do you remember
in 84,
that?
In 84. I was 6 months old, but go ahead.
With Steve Garvey, who was like a perfect foil. He's like the hero, anti-hero. And they, I think they went up like
2-0 in a best of five. Yeah.
And we were all in Iowa in the dorms, and all the Sox fans were rooting against them. And somehow, miraculously, the Padres came back and won 3-2. It was insane. But yeah, unfortunately, Sox fans, we have large chips on our shoulders. You know, we did get to title in 05.
That was great.
We're still trying.
I mean, here's what, when I watched 05, and then we'll move on, I promise. When I watched 05, I grew up with Sox fans in Downers Grove. And so all my friends were Sox fans. And I think that's why I'm very clearly like, I don't like the Sox, is because they would just rip me, right? It was all of them against me. And neither team was all that particularly good in the early 90s. The Sox won the division in 93, though. Were really good in the strike year of 94. So the Sox had like a good run when I was like 9 and 10 years old, which is when your friends are making fun of you the most for being a Cubs fan. So that's why I had a chip on my shoulder about being a Cubs fan. But I will say I had all those friends, and when the Sox won in 05, it was, first of all, an exciting run that the Sox went on, an epic playoff run. The pitching was insane. The sweep against the Houston Astros. Konerko hits the grand slam in game two. I was even like moved and like, oh my goodness. And I was jealous 100%. But there was a tinge of after the final out when, you know, you can't do anything about it anyways, I did go, well, I'm happy for my friends.
Oh, yeah. I had so many friends who were huge Cub fans. So, yeah, I felt good for them. I couldn't say I was rooting for the Cubs, but I felt good for all of them. It was such a huge moment. Plus, it was a likable team, the 2016 Cubs, like the 2005 Sox.
Yeah,
it was a likable, exciting team to watch. So it was hard to... A little bit hard to root against them, but
a little bit like both teams now. I think that they're both young, scrappy, fighting, extra base, trying to get every ounce out of the game as you can. And I think that's fun. Although now I'm respecting the Sox, and I said not this weekend. I wasn't going to do it.
Yeah,
but
it's okay. We'll cut that out.
Yeah,
it is fun. We're for a few years behind you. If we can kind of turn the corner, and if we get that South Loop Stadium, oh, my God, that would be fun.
I don't know if that's going to happen. But we'll see. It was kind of written as a wrinkle, perhaps, into the big law that still hasn't passed Springfield, but hopefully will, to keep the Bears in Illinois. Anyways, I digress. This is not a sports show. This is not a sports station, as some of the texters will start to chime in with. Why don't we take our break? We'll reset, and we'll do Let's Get Legal officially, all law talk from here on out. mostly, after this on WGN. Now, the 847 says, no easier way to alienate your loyal listeners than by proclaiming your allegiances to certain sports teams over and over again. Radio is being turned off now. Bye! I mean, I'm sorry. I'm going to just be who I am. Well, you want me to lie? Or maybe they're just saying I keep on talking
about it. It might have been a response to me hating the Cubs. I mean, who knows?
Yeah, I was going
to
say we were balanced here. You know, yeah. There's something for everyone here. Okay, well, it's not an airport. You don't have to announce your departure. Take it easy. Come back another time, I hope. 847 said, why don't you talk about legal baseball issues, like famous lawsuits in baseball? And I can only think of a couple. You mentioned the Flood story. Remind us of that one.
Yeah, Curt Flood, I think it's like 1967, sued with the idea that you couldn't move between teams. So that created free agency.
Yeah, it was a big one because teams used to own you, much like the movie studios used to own you, right?
Yeah, isn't that crazy to think about now with the movement there is? So that one, I would say, probably number one, although you could say in history, probably the one that got the most attention ever, 1919 Black Sox scandal.
Oh, boy, yeah.
That would be, I mean, imagine going back in time and seeing that trial. I mean.
Yeah, it's a wild one. Obviously made even more infamous by Field of Dreams, which I love that movie. Eight Men Out, of course. Yeah, thanks, Neil. But yeah, I mean, it would be interesting to see that whole trial play on out. You know, it's funny because I know the broad strokes, but I really have never done like a deep dive. I know that there's like Shoeless Joe might not have really even understood the bet he was making or the agreement. He played well in the World Series and that he shouldn't have done. I mean, basically, all I know about that is from Field of Dreams. So
yeah. Did you cry during Field of Dreams?
Yeah, probably.
I did, but I'm a crier.
I mean, how
but
can
I'm a
you
crier.
Not?
Come on. Yeah.
I mean, Dak and I have a catch or want to have a catch, which is a very East Coast way to say it, by the way.
Yeah. No, yeah. No one in Midwest says have a catch.
Have a catch. No,
yeah.
That's not a. That's,
let's go play catch.
Let's go play catch. Exactly. That was my only thing. That's why I cried.
And then
because it wasn't authentic to the Midwest.
And then number three, the only one that I think of that got so much attention was Barry Bonds, if you remember, was criminally prosecuted in federal court in San Francisco relating to the steroid stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, McGuire was and Sosa were called before Congress. I mean, that's a legal aspect, too. I'm sure there's others out there. If you know of any and you're thinking of any, 312-981-7200, famous baseball law stories where those two worlds collide. By the way, the 847 texted in a question about wills and estates. In the 2 o'clock hour, Millie Palmer will join us. So, Neil, let's save that 847 text for Millie Palmer in the 2 o'clock hour. Okay, well, 312-981-7200, if you got anything you want to chat with Mike Leonard about, he's a federal defense attorney, frequent guest on this show and many of the shows here on WGN. You wanted to start it off with a tribute, some sad news in the law world here in Chicago.
Yeah, a little in memoriam, a lawyer who's been in Chicago legal community for about 30 years, Jeff Charko, C-H-A-R-K-O-W, died last week. Big loss to the legal community. And I think the great thing about Jeff was, which I love seeing him because we'd always talk law in addition to socializing, but one of those people that loved being a lawyer, loved practicing law. He's not a guy that would ever say, gee, I hate my job or, wow, I don't want to be a lawyer. And you do see tons of lawyer dissatisfaction. We can talk about that later. Yeah, but he was always one that enjoyed it, loved trying cases, loved arbitrating cases, had just moved his partnership over to the firm called Duane Morris in Chicago from another firm, was really excited about that. So just a sad loss to the legal community. I know a lot of lawyers are familiar with him. And also, he was a huge supporter of something you're not going to know or understand, John. Zubaz.
Zubaz.
Z-U-B-A-Z.
Are those pants?
They're pants.
I knew Zubaz.
They can also be a sweatshirt, too, but they're famously the pants. They're the ugliest pants ever. They have, like, those stripes, you know, colored stripes. Kind of like what weightlifters used to wear in, like, the 80s.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
But Jeff was a big proponent of Zubaz, along with myself, in addition to a big fan of bourbon. So hats off to Jeff Charko.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's too bad. And 60 years old, young guy, too.
Yeah, that's
too bad. Well, my heart goes out to you, Mike, and all the other lawyers out there. It is, I imagine in some circles, it's a tight community.
Oh, totally. I mean, I think lawyers are, I mean, it kind of depends your practice area, but like in the criminal defense world, everyone kind of knows everybody, prosecutors and defense lawyers. In his commercial litigation area, he did focused on construction. Everybody kind of knows each other. So, yeah, it's in each little niche. Everyone is very familiar with each other, so it is a tight-knit community in a lot of ways, even though there's tons and tons of us in Chicago, as you told me, John, too many
lawyers. All right, you said you had a joke as well.
Yes,
this is appropriate, and
of course, radio of course, and appropriate. It's okay. And it's good for you in your state in life. So,
okay,
it what got me was, did you see the story this week where the mom, who's also part of the park district board, I think, in Markham,
the helicopter,
paid for a helicopter to apparently have her daughter arrive in and get out of for prom pictures.
That's cool.
Which I don't think it's cool at all. I think it's absurd. But it's a perfect example, John, of helicopter parenting.
Oh, Mike.
Come on.
That was right.
That's
there all
10.
Week.
That's a 10. John Williams is going to be jealous of something like that.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and a good thing he's on vacation, because
yeah,
he would not be happy that you came up with
that. No, that I stole that from him.
Exactly. Helicopter parenting. Gosh, someone has to have made that joke before already this week. That is a crazy story, and it is over the top. But it was, I watched the interview with her. There was a tinge of, I appreciated that she was trying to do something really special. Prom is a big deal for a lot of people. It's also a big deal in the Black community. I just want to say I've learned from a lot of reporters at Block Club. We've done a lot of stories about prom dresses and things along those lines. And not to say this is a race issue. It absolutely is not. But it is a big deal. And some people are like, well, it's not a big deal to me. Well, it is a big deal to certain people. And it was, I think, to her family. And so part of me is like, yeah, you did the wrong thing. But I love that someone's trying to do something big for their kid in a big moment for them, right?
Yeah, I mean, prom is huge. I'm going to oppose you and rest my case, but
yeah.
But prom is huge. I mean, John, back in the day, I wore a white suit with a purple cummerbund. I mean, do they even make those anymore? I don't think so.
That's peak 1983.
It was 84. It's a great look at the time.
Yeah,
at the time, a great look.
You got any pictures on your phone that I can look at right now and describe to the listeners?
I would never show it to you. But what did you go with?
I probably just went, black suits were very in. I don't even know if I wore a tux. I don't remember. I'd have to think through it. But like, also, it's funny because like I was pretty much a goody two shoe in high school. I've talked about this on GN before. Not the same situation in college. But like, you know how like so many groups of friends, that's a night to like, you know, have a night to remember in so many different ways. Like me and my friends just like went back to my buddy's place and like played video games.
Yeah.
Not a drink was had, and I mean, which is fine, and that's good.
Yeah.
That's probably a good thing, obviously, to promote on the station, but it's just, it wasn't like a memorable, you know, John Hanson, and about the town, or running Downers Grove, you know?
Yeah, I didn't view it as the be-all, end-all. I just remember it as a fun night, but I just, looking back, seeing the pictures, I like the fact that it had so little style, because when I look at pictures now, it's very fun to look at. And of course, my date had a red dress, which made no sense that I'm wearing a white tux with purple. But, you know, back in those days, you would never coordinate with your girlfriend. Like, hey, what color are you wearing? That was unheard of.
Right, boy. We're really diving into the law stories.
We are. This is deep.
708. And this is actually a deep question. My question for Mike Leonard. Why do you prefer to defend criminals instead of prosecute criminals? And I guess this is a choice that a lot of lawyers have to make at a certain point, right? Which side of the litigation are you going to be on? And for me, I want to just say it's in your DNA and in your blood to defend, but that's also because I know you and that's how it is. When did you make that decision?
Good question. That's interesting. So first of all, as a background, when I was in law school, you know, you do these internships.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of my summer internships or during the school internships was with the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. And so the amazing and cool thing about that back then, and I think it still is true now, is that you could have what's called your 7-Eleven license. John, no, that's not from the grocery store. From
the chain, yeah.
Yeah, rule 7-Eleven. So you're a law student. You have licensed under 7-Eleven. So under the tutelage of whatever prosecutors were in your courtroom that you were assigned to, you could, as a second chair or third chair, try actual cases. Before you got your law degree. Mm. So, but, you know, you're relegated to the tiniest of cases. But I remember in law school trying as a prosecutor, as a distant second chair, as a case where, you know, basically someone's accused of having stolen tools in their truck, getting the conviction, being, you know, really euphoric. I mean,
you were really thrilled to.
Oh, my God. Coming back to school that
day. Lock them up. You were happy.
I mean, it was just exciting doing a real trial. I mean, I was very active in our mock trial program and on mock trial team, but this was real life. So it was very exciting to me. I almost went the prosecutor direction out of law school. Instead, I went to a firm at the time that was really about 80% civil work because they just were loaded with trial lawyers. It was kind of the place to be at the time. And when I was in that firm, there were some famous prosecutors. For instance, Bill Kunkel, who tried Gacy, was there. Mm-hmm. There was a couple former federal prosecutors. So definitely, even then, I was still thinking about making the switch. But then what happened was, I think, probably, is we had some high-profile cases we defended. And one of them, I worked with Kunkel and another prosecutor, Pat Foley, who had been a federal prosecutor, and we defended the case up in Skokie. It was hugely high profile. It was one of the only murders that's ever occurred in Kenilworth, Illinois. And just, you know, being part of that team and seeing what goes into that. And then, you know, going over to federal court and seeing those piles of evidence in federal prosecutions, I'm like, I want in on that. And I was lucky enough to get in on the defense side through those lawyers, right? So it was kind of my entree. And so it just became a natural progression to move to the defense side. And I do agree with you. I think it is more in my DNA to be defending the little guy. You know, the government has all the resources in the world. You feel like you're up against it all the time. So I think it does fit my personality more, defending someone who may be falsely accused or giving them representation they need in a very oftentimes unbalanced system.
I'm going to connect the two things here then, and then we're going to go to news. You sat there in your classroom in Arlington Heights surrounded by Cubs fan, and you decided to be a Sox fan. The contrarian route was more fun. There you sit in a lawyer's firm with a bunch of heavy-hitting prosecutors, and you end up saying, I'm going to fight against that side.
Well, but remember, they were former prosecutors, so they had gone
to the... I'm just saying.
Yeah, it makes sense. But also, a lot of it is like luck, what you're exposed to and what opportunities you have. Like, if the chance would have presented in those early years to move to prosecution office, I'm sure that's what I'd be doing today. And I'd be talking about that and how horrible defense attorneys like me are.
Yeah, we probably wouldn't have you on then. That's boring. All right, Mike Leonard, we're going to take questions from folks. I'm sure you got some other trials you want to talk about. Mike Leonard, our federal defense attorney, I got a few things for you. Let's start with the person who texted in that they have a pot arrest from 1998 for possession of under an eighth. This person who lives in Florida now, they're wondering, did I hear right that Illinois passed a law that all of those records are being expunged automatically? Do I have to actively do it? You looked into a little of this. What did you find?
Yeah, so the Clean Slate Act will essentially seal, they estimate, up to a couple million offenses going back decades.
What do you mean by seal?
Well, basically, they can't be used as base. They won't be able to. So you run a search on someone, you won't find them. So it's the same thing as expunging them, essentially. So they won't be able to be found, right? And because of the breadth of the law, it applies not just to drug offenses, but to a lot of nonviolent offenses as well. So it sounds like from Pritzker's press release, the initial time period they'll focus on is like 2005 going forward, and then the work will go into the older conviction. So for this gentleman, it is a gentleman, right?
I think so.
Okay. It will be, according to the law and the press release about the law, it will be sealed and expunged. It may take another year or two for it to happen, but you won't have to do the kind of laborious process where it varies by each county and you have to do all sorts of paperwork, go before a judge. This will make it automated and it'll apply to a number of offenses, not just drug offenses.
One lawyer we haven't had on as much as we used to, but she's great, Audrey Anderson from Anderson Attorneys and Advisors. She does expungement work, or at least she did back in the day. I went ahead and texted her, Audrey's number, which is 630-877-5800, if anyone else is wondering how that works. We had a call in the news, Mike, wondering, and I think the caller like understands the idea of having a defense generally, but thinks that drunk drivers or people accused of driving under the influence should not be allowed to have a defense attorney, and they should go straight to jail. I just want to first say I understand why a lot of people feel that way. Drunk driving drives a lot of people crazy. Perhaps this person, I have no idea, just generally feels that way. Maybe they've had it impact their life in some horrific way, and sympathies to them if that's the case. What's your response to saying that drunk drivers or alleged drunk drivers should not have a defense?
Well, look, just like you, from an emotional standpoint, I can completely relate to that sentiment. However, just like any other case, you know, the people aren't always guilty, right? So I know that might feel good, but that kind of rush to justice is not justice. Police don't always get it right. The evidence isn't always there. Sometimes the people haven't done it. So you can't do that, unfortunately, or fortunately. But, you know, we can't have that kind of system. And I'm fighting a case right now where my client was arrested for drunk driving was not the driver. And despite they charged the two people who were in the car, because they were both out of the car by the time the police got there. It was a crash. No one was hurt. It was late at night. It was property damage to another car. They were both out of the car when the police arrived. They charged my client with drunk driving, even though she wasn't the driver, even though we have a sworn statement from the driver saying she was the driver.
But the other person says, no, it was me.
Correct. And they still charged my client. And right now, we're still set to go to trial on that, where that person will have to testify, the person who gave the sworn statement, because they won't accept it. Why? I don't know.
Well, then what's the counter evidence that a prosecutor's going to come?
There's not going to be any. That's what's so silly about it. We're trying to get the case resolved, but we can't.
This is a slam dunk for you if it goes to trial.
Oh, yeah, but at least...
But then your client's got to pay more money to you.
Well, no, not more. We usually do a fixed fee in those types of cases.
Oh, okay.
So, it's not, I'm not economically driven on it, just the absurdity of that situation. And yeah, that's not the norm, but there's lots of cases where law enforcement gets it wrong, or the person's not guilty, or the person's innocent, you know. So look, we can't do that, but I understand emotionally where that's coming from.
This might be a sensitive question. Feel free not to answer it, because I hear different people say different things. If you're pulled over, and let's not even say whether you've been drinking or not, and they ask you to take a breathalyzer, should you do it?
Well, if you haven't been drinking, I would say absolutely. If you have been drinking, I would not do it.
Okay.
And I'll leave it at that.
I'll leave it at that. Okay. But don't drink and drive, people. I mean, I think that's a blanket.
Yeah, no one's a supporter of that.
Yes. You know? Okay. I just want to make sure it's clear. Hi, John, says the 612. Can you have Mike explain the difference, and I don't know if there is one, between an accomplice and an accessory?
It depends on the jurisdiction you're in, of course. The problem is you can't broadly answer that for all jurisdictions because they all define that differently. But
oh, really?
I view that more as an accomplice, meaning someone who's participating in the crime in some active way. An accessory can be someone who
tangentially is related
to it.
Well,
helps the crime either before or after, you know, usually after. The accessories are usually people who are involved after the crime has been committed. You know, they might harbor them or aid their flight, something like that. So that's kind of the general differentiation, but it can be defined in a particular jurisdiction as the same.
Okay, so the two people who committed the crime are accomplices, and then after the fact, if someone hides them away in their garage, that would be an accessory.
Correct.
Broadly speaking.
Broadly speaking.
Okay, very good. 312-981-7200. You wanted to talk about, it's been an interesting week for you, huh?
Yeah, some weeks are just fun from the kind of the diversity of what you have to do in a given week and what you get to get involved in. First of all, until about Tuesday at noon, I was debilitated, John. I couldn't function until my argument was over.
Wait, what do you mean?
Because I had a Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals federal court argument on Tuesday.
Ah.
So you go over there at 8:30, you find out what time you're going to be up, you find out who the panel of three is going to be, and until that argument is done, you can't continue your week because it's just messing
weighs
with
on
your,
you.
It's messing with your head.
Is it because it's a big deal in appellate?
Yeah, it's a
court?
Big deal. Yeah, especially in federal court, it's a big deal. You're kind of in an august courtroom. You know, there's the mystery of when you show up, who your panel is going to be. In the old days, you know, going back 10 to 20 years ago, when you showed up, I'm not going to name any names, but I will give a little insider baseball. There were two names you were hoping would not be on that list of three. Now it's down to one. But, you know, it was a great panel. I appeared in front of very professional, peppered me with the questions from the outset. But maybe people don't know the difference between trial and appellate work. But when you have an appeal and they give your oral argument, which is normal, you have a given amount of time. So you step up to the podium. You know, if you're representing the party appealing, you step up the podium. There's a green light and there's a clock. And we were only given 10 minutes in this case. Sometimes you get 20, sometimes you get 30. So the clock's ticking down, the electronic clock.
My gosh.
And you start your argument. And, you know, normally on an appeal, you have anywhere from one to three or four issues. You're not trying to throw everything against the wall. You need to focus on the issues that really matter. And so the clock starts ticking. You start your argument. And the three judges can ask you whatever they want, whenever they want. So you might get one word out and you might be like, Mr. Leonard, what about this? You know, something.
And the clock still ticks.
Oh, yeah. The clock ticks.
While they ask your questions?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And so so you can be interrupted at any time with any question they want to ask. It could be about a case that one or more of the parties have cited. It might be about a factual issue. It might be about something what about this in the transcript? Didn't this witness say blah, blah, blah? You know, so. And
can I ask one more question?
Sure.
Are you also filing briefs that they have?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So they wouldn't miss out on an entire argument because they asked too many questions about one thing. They'd be able to, in their own chambers, in their own time, read through your entire argument.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah. Okay. This is a very well-developed process. So, first of all, the appealing party submits the first brief, you know, lengthy, with citations, you know, to every fact in the record. If you're saying, you know, Joe Smith testified this, you're citing to page 14, line 7, whatever. And then if you are talking about the case law, you're trying to find cases that are analogous to your case or your situation, typically, hopefully, from your own jurisdiction. But if you can't find support, you might be looking outside your jurisdiction. So you got to know the record, meaning what happened at trial, backwards and forwards, what everyone said. And then you also got to be well conversant in the cases that the government's relying upon and you're relying upon, right? They might ask you, well, what about the Johnson case? Where isn't that like this case? Mm-hmm. You know, so you got to be ready for anything. So it's this, you know, so both sides submit the extensive briefs. You have the last word with a reply brief. So they've digested that all. They also have plenty of law clerks and career clerks who are reading these things. So they come in with an agenda, meaning they have particular questions that they want to ask. Once in a rare while, a panel will be very complacent. They won't ask many questions or zero, you know, and that's what they choose to do.
I don't know if that'd be good or bad.
It just depends. I mean, it's hard to read them, but you can get a pretty clear sense of which way a judge is going.
And you need two.
Based upon the questions, you need two out of three. So it's a fun chance, and you need to be able to stand your ground on particular issues because they're looking for admissions, right? Like, well, counsel even acknowledged that, you know, blah, blah, blah. So, but you can't also stand your ground to the degree that you're defying logic or common sense or your argument doesn't make any sense. And you've seen that in a lot of Supreme Court arguments.
Supreme Court cases, right.
So
I feel like this is all just good practice for you and for when you finally get to the big show at the Supreme Court.
Someday. But if you want to see a group of nervous, stressed out lawyers walk over to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, 27th floor, any day that there's arguments, get there to that hallway at about 8:30, quarter to 9, you'll see a group of stressed out looking people that you've never seen, that you've never imagined before. And it reminds me of being in law school when you had a mock trial competition and everyone would congregate on the second floor waiting to do their arguments, their mock trials. And we called it the awkward donut room. But the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals hallway, it's a sea of stress is what it is.
Okay, we got to take a break. I can't wait to hear where the week takes you next. From the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which is fascinating, to what? We'll find out with Mike Leonard, federal defense attorney, after this on Let's Get Legal on WGN. 150 on WGN, John Hansen here. It's Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. I almost said on the map because I was filling in for Plyer, and then I almost said your money matters. But no, this one's Let's Get Legal. And Mike Leonard's our federal defense attorney, who is telling us about his week, which really was all bottled up until he got through his appeal at the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals on Tuesday, which sounds like a harrowing process to go through, not knowing who you're going to have as a judge. You got 10 minutes. It's pressure-filled, and it's important as can be. Thumbs up, thumbs down. How'd you feel it went?
Well, I felt like I did what I needed to do. I mean, it was a tough case coming in, so you're always worried about that, you know. You know, if you're appealing, you're always, you know, in trouble. Let's face it, you know, so the odds are against you. But in terms of what I thought I needed to do, I thought it went pretty well. The interesting thing is they're audio live streamed and also audio taped. So
why did you tell me this ahead of time? I would have listened in.
Because you'd be critiquing me the whole time, John.
Let's pull that up, Neil.
We could actually, it'd be kind of funny to play a minute on some episode. But the funny thing is, since you can listen to it, of course, I can't help at the end of the day, like when it's kind of out of my head a little bit, like to listen to it. And, you know, you'll feel good about certain sections. And you'll be like, why didn't I do better on that question? Or, you know,
trust me, I go through this all the time.
You listen, you re-listen?
I listen to some things I do back. It's not healthy, I think, to listen to every minute you're ever on the radio. But if you're going to get better, I think there is some self-reflection you do when you listen to yourself and go. For me, it was also I always used to talk way too fast on this station. Some people still think I do. So just like slowing down a little bit and other like technical things or the way I ask a question, you know, or, you know, there's things that you critique, but you don't want to do it too much because you don't want to get in your own head. You know?
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of sometimes painful to listen to yourself, as you can imagine. Listen to me, John, would be painful. But
I have to do it all the time.
But it's also kind of interesting because you can kind of, obviously, it's sometimes when you have you can take a step back and listen to it, and then you can see, oh, okay, you know, I could have done this, could have said that. But, you know, I felt generally good about
That's good. We got about 4 more minutes. Where else do you want to go with your week?
So, yeah, it was interesting in a sense. So you had that, and then we had a couple of those student cases that we have.
Oh, yeah, the ones where you're defending students in the university, not in a court of law, but in front of the judicial system that they have at the college, right?
Yeah, so universities are pretty uniform, colleges and universities, in terms of how they do their hearings. And the charges can be anything from misuse of AI to copying someone's homework to copying off someone's exam, to having someone take your exam, to sexual misconduct, to drinking,
everything,
drugs, doing something at another campus. So we've had, like, literally, you know, those things I just said.
It's a growing part of your practice,
yeah,
too,
right? Yeah, we've had those cases, but we've had anything you can imagine. They're almost like pseudo-criminal cases because you're being accused of something, and the consequences are high, just like a criminal case, that the repercussions can be anywhere from probation to suspension to expulsion. So they're tough cases in that respect.
What's the proof standard of proof? It's not like beyond a reasonable doubt
in
court.
No, here's the bad part. It's a more likely than not standard. So the initial panel is going to decide, you know, it's usually 2 or 3 professors on the initial panel, and they're all very often done by Zoom. The attorneys have to take a very backseat role. We're not allowed to cross-examine. We're not even allowed to ask the questions to our own clients. We can suggest things to them. We can confer with them. We can take breaks. But the big thing that comes up strategically is getting them ready for it. One of the biggest things is they get to do an opening. Not the attorney, the student gets to do an opening. So preparing them to do that opening, and then also preparing them to answer the questions from the panel.
Are these judges that are in the panel?
No.
They're just administrators?
They're not judges at all. They're not in any way judges. They're just professors who are assigned to be on this panel. And I think it's very interesting because I kind of told the story to somebody else, but academics are very interesting when they're involved in litigation process. I mean, when I've taken depositions of academics, it's very, very hard for them to cede control and to answer the question. They're so unused to that. That's why it's very fun taking their depositions. Now, conversely, when
trust me, we talk to a lot of professors here at WGN. I know what you're saying.
Yeah, and conversely, when they're on panels, they're really acting as judges. I think it's difficult for them too. What I've noticed recently, it's very hard for them to ask hard questions and to kind of take on the topic. I think they're almost too deferential to the process and to the student, but they have to ask the questions because they're the fact finder, right?
Yeah.
So when it gets done, they issue their findings of fact, basically in writing, and then they make a decision, you know, is the student guilty of the conduct or not? And then what's the recommended punishment, which then goes up, you know, it might go up another step or two.
Do the vast majority of students have no legal representation and they just do it on their own?
Hard to say statistically. I mean, I think more and more students are hiring lawyers like us, and it's called an advisor. So
yeah,
your advisor could be you, it could be your parent, it could be a lawyer. But I think more and more they're turning to lawyers because the consequences are steep.
They're sometimes maybe more severe than the criminal case.
Yeah. So
I mean, it's in terms of your reputation and then where you can go for a job afterwards and stuff.
Brutal, and with an incredibly low legal standard, without a lot of the protections of due process, without the right to really legitimately confront and cross-examine witnesses, sometimes not at all. So I think it's a really skewed system against the students. So I think that's why more and more students are turning to lawyers like us to provide representation.
Should public universities have maybe a more centralized court for this sort of stuff?
I think so. I think there's something in between. Like, each school could have something that represents or resembles more of a court. I mean, you don't want to go full in where there's a trial on every, you know, allegation of misconduct. But when the stakes are this high, getting kicked out of school, maybe impacting your career, we got to have a little more safeguards.
We got to go. Mike, you do that with the college stuff. I think people know that if they're arrested or something, to call you. But I think if you've got a kid or a grandkid in college and they are accused of something, where can people reach you at?
Sure. 312-380-6559 for people who are charged with or being investigated for crimes in state court or federal court. kids in college or universities being accused of misconduct, and we also represent whistleblowers.
It's always good to talk to you, Mike.
Good to see you, buddy. Go Sox!
Go Cubs!